Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport. This week, live from Waterloo Station, where David Law and I are surrounded by both pigeons and signs asking us to help Waterloo Station prevent the domination of pigeons, which I don't think we're doing because our table is scattered with coffee cups and tea bags and milk and all the sort of stuff which apparently attracts pigeons.
I think they've spotted our microphone tennis podcast cubes and are fancying gate crashing the show Rosie style.
There is a little harem of pigeons. I don't think that's the official term for a group of pigeons, but there is a small harem gathering to our right. So
I'll take a photo of them just to prove this.
Just going to turn my back on them and try to ignore their presence in our recording. But if you hear the flapping of wings, that is what is going on. David Law is alongside me for the first time since sort of midway through second week of the US Open, at which stage I was stricken by the lurgy. And you've hot-footed it from the BT Sport commentary booth, David.
Yeah, where I've just been commentating on all manner of matches, and an increasingly taxing season is taking its toll on a number of players. Garbiñe Muguruza has arrived from Wuhan, she says, with a virus. She lost 6-1, 2-love, retired. Sloane Stephens has played four sets of tennis since the US Open and lost the lot. 6-2, 6-2, 6-3, 6-love. And, I mean, I don't know how she's feeling physically, but in her post-match press conference, she said that, you know, just didn't happen today and hopefully next week. But I saw match point in that particular match. Maybe she just thought this isn't happening today because, frankly, she wasn't even running for ball. So I don't know whether she's feeling unwell, but she certainly didn't look up for it.
But she's possibly not the best example, I think, of the wider point you're making about everyone just looking completely exhausted, because, of course, she's played less than half the season than the other players have played. And with exceptions, everyone looks... They've got that sort of slightly David Law-esque, hollow-eyed look to them.
What?
I'm saying you are quite often quite tired,
oh,
David.
Okay, thank you, Catherine. but the thing is, one thing I would say, I mean, I agree with you, it is a long season. I know it's faffing around on planes and going to tennis tournaments and playing tennis matches and living the life of Riley, so really shouldn't be too sorry for them, but it is quite tiring, I think, for them.
We're not necessarily, you know, commiserating or, you know, offering our huge sympathy, but it is just a fact.
No,
if you're knackered, you're knackered.
Yeah, it is a fact. One thing I did talk to Sam Smith, former British number one, on air about today, though, when we were doing Angelique Kerber's match, she lost, incidentally, to Elise Cornet. We were talking about how once you've got to the very peak, if you're not the sort of player who's necessarily going to dominate or do this over and over again, or if you're just not of that personality type, it is possible that you may get to that position and find it quite hard to motivate yourself again. And although I think Kerber's tried hard this year, she's quite clearly more happy within herself, being a little bit more within the pack rather than the standout player. Sloane Stephens, we've no idea yet whether she really is going to be quite... I know she was... she was quite endearing and funny in her post-match on-court interview at the US Open, saying, are you kidding me? Did you see that check in terms of how much she wanted to win again? But, I mean, realistically, she's a multimillionaire. Is she bothered enough by multiple trophies to keep on doing it, particularly at events that don't have $3.6 million on offer to the winner and history of that type?
And when you're not necessarily, there's no sort of big fat dangling carrot in front of you, but albeit financial, or, you know, okay, she had an outside shot of making Singapore, but I don't think enough for that to be an enormous motivator at the front of her mind. And the fact is, the race to Singapore, I know Jo Konta isn't there yet, and we'll talk about her strife shortly, but the fact is, it's pretty much set. With the exception maybe of Konta, Kuznetsova, Ostapenko. So there's not a lot for these women to be playing for, finances aside. If you're knackered, I do think that trip east is the most punishing jet lag-wise. I know Australia is punishing, but you know, it's at the start of the season, you're most fresh, you generally go out there nice and early and have more time to adjust, etc., etc. I think this one's tough because I think that the players want to take as much time as possible off after the US Open, so they're probably not going out really early. And frankly, just coming back from New York, for me, I slept for 17 hours straight the first day I was back.
I didn't know that was humanly possible until you told me that.
I woke up for breakfast for 20 minutes. It was in La Manga, first day in La Manga. I was thinking, oh, I'm going to play all this tennis. I just slept for 70. I could not keep my eyes open. It was extraordinary. And but on the way out, I was fine. I do think west to east is very, very difficult. And yeah, look, I'm not offering them my huge sympathy for suffering from jet lag after their first class flights to a week where they're being treated wonderfully and get to play tennis for a living. But it's a fact. It's tough, you know, that you can have all the money in the world, but you can't pay jet lag to stay away.
This time of the year as well, things are so crammed together because, you know, the final of Wuhan took place 2 days into Beijing, which I'm sure there is a perfectly decent logistical reason why that is the case, but I do think that is self-defeating and a shame because, you know, you want to make all this hoopla about the final of a big Premier 5 tournament like Wuhan and celebrate Caroline Garcia's brilliant win, her first major win of that ilk, up against the story of the tournament in many ways in Ash Barty, and yet here you are on day two of Beijing and it's Maria Sharapova against Anastasia Sevastova, and it's like, what? Surely you want to give a window, first of all, to the Wuhan final.
Yeah, I mean, we're raising all these issues and they're not new debate points in tennis, are they? They're well-worn-out debate points and we don't have any answers, do we? I mean, you don't want to get rid of any of these events off the calendar. They've all got their right to be there. They're all paying their money. They all, in the majority, are well attended, and I do think the attendance is growing in the Far East. I think it's taken its time, but I do think it's getting there.
Yeah, it is, and that tournament in Wuhan, there were some disappointments with certain players struggling, but it was a fantastic final for a start. I mean, I didn't actually get to watch it live, but I watched it recorded today. I didn't realise that Barty was serving for the match, and Garcia, I almost want to say of all people, because she's not really shown herself to be the type over the years to me that she's somebody who will dig out victory from the jaws of defeat.
She's not known for her grit, is she?
No, and yet she showed something this last week. Whether she can carry that on, who knows, but good for her.
Yeah, absolutely. And a week where all four semi-finalists, Barty, Sakkari, Ostapenko, who we're going to talk about a lot as well, and of course Caroline Garcia, all under the age of 24, I believe, which is pretty exciting, I think, for women's tennis. It's a, you know, Wuhan's a big event.
And Barty, I mean, Garcia, if you didn't remember, is the player that Andy Murray picked as a future world number one all those years ago when she was a set and 4-1 up against Maria Sharapova at the French Open. He was watching on TV and he said, mark my words, this is a future world number one. Now, maybe that's a stretch at this point. But Ash Barty has gone through a pretty tumultuous time of her own, gone the scenic route, gone into another sport completely, gave up tennis a couple of years ago, took up cricket, became pretty good at that, then came back to tennis.
Is there a better story in tennis than Ash Barty? I mean, the answer is probably yes, because there are so many great stories in tennis at the moment, and Serena Williams giving her daughter the initials of the Australian Open because she won the Australian Open with her earlier this year. That's a pretty good story.
What's the name?
Waiting to happen. Alexis Ohanian. Alexis Olympia Ohanian.
Pretty cool.
I like that. And then if, you know, we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but if she goes on to win the Australian Open in January with baby daughter by her side. Anyway, that's just one example of one great little story. But, I mean, as a wonderful... I mean, you could already make a film out of Ash Barty. You'd probably need her to win, you know, Wimbledon or something for scriptwriters to actually take note and do that. But it's a cracking story. Junior Wimbledon champion, just fell out of love with the game, didn't enjoy the pressures of it. She's a very relatable human being, isn't she? Such a watchable style of play, Martina Hingis-esque. Yeah. You tweeted, I think, earlier in the week that if you don't like watching Ash Barty play tennis, you don't like tennis. And I think that's a really astute comment. And she also has the advantage of being a player that, because it's a style that you don't see that often, nobody wants to play her, not least Joe Konta. I mean, it's just, it's awkward, isn't it? It's not an enjoyable experience for big hitters.
And of course, Konta had got herself back from love 6, love 1 down in the first round against Barty to serve for the match, and then end up losing it in a deciding set tiebreak. So a bit of a heartbreaker for Konta, who then went on to have further problems, which we'll come on to. But Barty's run, I mean, she beat all the top players, basically, to end up getting to the final and very nearly took the title. And in terms of that style of play, I can't think of anybody, really. I mean, I'd almost have to go back to somebody like Amélie Mauresmo or Justine Henin in terms of, I mean, okay, she doesn't have a single-handed topspin backhand, but she has that slice to add to the forehand.
Yeah.
She's happy to come forward. She's a great doubles player. She's not tall, but my goodness, is she fun to watch.
Yeah, and she took care of Yelena Ostapenko, the prime example of big hitters not enjoying playing her. I mean, was there ever a greater contrast
styles? Another one, Ostapenko, just hit the wall. She'd had a lot of big, heavy-duty matches, and she just got, frankly, nothing left in the tank, really.
So what's the answer, David Law?
I don't know.
These players hitting the wall?
I don't know. I mean, I think that they... Ideally, you would take some tournaments out of the calendar. You would stop
them
playing quite as many.
But given that we all know that ain't happening.
No, I don't know what the answer is then. No idea.
You've got a secret jet lag trick, haven't you? What's that?
Can you
market it and make your millions?
It's legal
for tennis podcast listeners, though, so share your secret.
It's these little gummy bear sweets.
Gummy bears, or you can make them sound innocuous all you like, David.
Apparently they've got melatonin in. Apparently that's all right.
Do you think that's what the players could write on their TUE declaration
Maybe.
Forms? Little gummy bear things.
TPUE, tennis podcast exemption. TUE. I don't know. I can't even... I'm so tired, I can't remember the talk.
Yeah, okay, you need some gummy bear type things. We've got no answers, have we?
No.
Well, no feasible answers. I mean, yeah, I agree, you take some tournaments.
What would you like to do? What would Catherine and listeners do?
Don't know. I really don't know. Take some tournaments. There are too many tournaments, but we all know that just isn't happening. There's just no way.
You know, not to
unilaterally... It's more likely that they'll add... I mean, we're adding stuff.
For the greater good.
We spent last week talking about the Laver Cup. You know.
It's good though, isn't it?
That's a complete bonus. That's, yeah, I mean, we briefly touched upon the fact that, you know, it celebrating this addition to the calendar in the context of all this, you know, the debate about the calendar just being far too long, ridiculous. I believe that ITPL isn't returning this year.
Well, put it this way, the website hasn't been updated for about... Well, the social media no posts for about 4 months, and the website says can't be found.
So that'll be a brief extra respite for the top players, although, you know, they'll play exhibitions to in lieu of that, won't they? Well, certainly the very top players will.
There's fewer opportunities now to play tennis because of the supposed demise, alleged demise of IFPTL. So, you know, maybe that will help them have a proper holiday.
Proper holiday? What, 3.5 weeks?
Sounds brilliant. Can we have one of those?
Right then, who else to talk about? Yelena Ostapenko, someone who's hit the wall. Garbiñe Muguruza retired earlier on today in Beijing. She seems to have completely hit the wall, which is a shame because you want to see her walking onto the court as the world number one, which she did for her first match. She strode onto court, but I'm not sure what she's got left.
I think the one hope is that, I mean, she talked about feeling as though she got a virus coming on. Hopefully that's a cold of some ilk. And, I mean, she still has got 2.5 weeks until Singapore starts. So let's hope that by the time she plays that first match in Singapore, she's bang on it. Because the sport really could do with a world number one coming in and carrying that mantle like the world number one and others targeting her. That's what the sport needs. That's what the WTA finals needs.
Yeah, I completely agree. I love hearing bang on it said in a Brummie accent, by the way. It sounds so much better than when I say it. Bang. Bang.
See?
Sort of got a little mini extra syllable on the end there.
Excellent.
There was another event going on last week on the WTA Tour in Tashkent, Uzbekistan. You ever been to Uzbekistan?
No,
David,
I haven't.
Can't give us a little travel
Not
review
yet,
of
no.
Uzbekistan.
I can't tell you who was... I'll tell you, I did see one match where both players were wearing leggings and hoodies. It was so cold.
It's like playing tennis in Solihull.
The tournament was glorious.
Tournament was won by Katerina Bondarenko.
Oh, did I tell you about the match I played in Solihull on that subject the other day?
Is it Solihull? Is the emphasis on Hull?
Yeah.
It's not Solihull. It's Solihull.
Yeah. And did I tell you about how... I did tell you on Messenger, didn't I? About if I could just bottle that performance.
Yeah. That's a sort of humble brag, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
In fact, on
reflection, that's a massive humble brag. Well, you're sort of saying, oh, I was brilliant tonight, but I can't be brilliant. I can't be that brilliant all of the time.
Can't be against you, which is the major annoyance.
Anyway, Tashkent, Bondarenko the winner, but the story, no offence to Bondarenko, Vera Zvonareva, who almost reached her second consecutive WTA final on her comeback. 33 years of age, 2 years... She is 33.
No.
I looked it up. Yeah.
I'm Googling that sharpish.
I Googled it at 33 years of age.
Sure you didn't put a typo in that? How is she 33?
Well, Wikipedia thinks she's 33 years of age.
What does Wikipedia know about it? Let's have a look. Didn't she? She reached two Grand Slam finals.
Two Grand Slam finals, US Open and Wimbledon. She's been out.
33.
She's 33. Yeah.
1984. Ooh. Goodness me. 198 in the world.
So she's had a couple of years out, but realistically, it's been more than a couple of years since she's been, a going concern in women's tennis. And she's just decided. She's decided to have another stab.
Yeah, good for her. That's fantastic news. I'm really pleased.
So, yeah, I mean, she's still ranked, she's got no great ranking to speak of. We're not going to see her. I suppose she'd be in with a good shout for wild cards at Slams, I suppose. Certainly those where she's been a finalist, I would expect her to get wild cards. I don't know whether we'll be seeing her in Australia. But anyway.
2012, she finished her lowest finish in 11 years because of injury. Then she didn't play in 2013, played just 5 events in 2014, 8 events in 2015. Yeah, I mean, she's basically been out of the game for 4 or 5 years.
That was all off the top of your head, wasn't it, David?
And my phone.
You're encyclopedic head. So, yeah, welcome back, 33-year-old Vera Zvonareva.
Brilliant.
Who we've all branded just old. Here on the tennis podcast.
A bit rich, isn't it?
Yeah.
Actually, another comeback I've just thought of as well, I've been reading about recently, a couple of big results for Belinda Bencic, who I've seen posing with trophies and looking happy. And she is somebody who, 2 years ago, we thought this is a player who's going to be a regular in the top 10 and winning slams, or at least competing for slams. I really hope she's back.
Yeah.
Like Barty, another just a different type of player.
A glory to watch. And another Hingis-esque player. Of course, she's had the direct influence of Martina Hingis and her mum. Worryingly for Bencic, the most recent injury setback for her was wrist. And you hear the words wrist injury in tennis and you do shudder a bit, don't you? Because... obviously we hope this isn't the case, but very rarely does someone have a wrist injury, have a surgery, take some time off, whatever, come back and never again experience problems for the rest of their career. That's I can't think of an example of that, very sadly. But we wish her well. She's still only 21.
Oh, that's a bit more reassuring, isn't it? Because, 33 was a bit much.
I saw her pose. I know that because I saw her posing, I think, on Instagram with a 21st birthday cake. It was a while ago, though, so we've missed the opportunity to say congratulations. We had men's events in Chengdu and Shenzhen last week. In Chengdu, we had Dennis Istomin, the titleist. Very well done to him. Very happy moment for him. But a truly distressing moment for Marcos Baghdatis in the final, who was going for his first title in 7 years. I mean, and a very large part of the reason he hasn't won a title in the last 7 years is because he's been so very blighted by injury. Lovely, lovely guy. Probably would be the first to admit he's not maxed on his potential due to factors including injury. But there's few players who are unilaterally wished as well as Marcos Baghdatis.
Yeah, he seems like a lovely fellow.
Absolutely nobody would have wished for...
He was crestfallen. Oh. He was absolutely devastated. 2-3 down in the first set of that final that he'd worked so hard to get to. He served and basically fell over because his body just would not hold him up. He pulled something, I think, in his back or something like that. And yeah, poor old, and very nice moment. Dennis Istomin came over to console him immediately on the floor. Oh, it was hard to watch.
It's further evidence of just what a brutal, physically demanding sport this has become. I know there have always been injuries, but you know, the Baghdatis injury occurred in the same week that we've heard that Janko Tipsarevic is having to have yet more surgery. He says this is going to be his last throw of the dice. He's going to attempt to come back, or plans to attempt to come back once more after that. I mean, the sport has never been more physically brutal than it is right now, and I think there's, you know, plenty of evidence for that out there. But yeah, well done, Dennis Istomin. I've been to Chengdu.
You don't look that pleased with it.
If I was making a trip to Chengdu, I would be annoyed if I didn't come away with a trophy in my hands.
And you didn't.
I didn't. No, to come away empty-handed, having spent a week in Chengdu, let alone with an injury, is a pretty sorry state of affairs.
You should come to Solihull.
Pandas are great, but other than that, I don't have a particularly glorious tourist write-up about Chengdu.
I'm
not going
like?
To slag off Shenzhen because I've never been there. I'm okay. Sure it's wonderful.
Yeah, I haven't been either. But anyway.
They had a wonderful final.
Yes.
Goffin and Dolgopolov. Dolgopolov played the match of his life. Goffin? How has David Goffin not won a title since 2014?
That was just complacent, isn't it?
It was just a stat that had sort of passed me by a bit until he won this one.
Yeah. Remember when I said that is a match I'd love to see
he'd
a few
lost,
months back?
Did you?
I did, yeah. Yeah, look it up. But I didn't actually see it after all that. I was busy. Sorry, everybody. But I bet it was good. I'm going to go and watch that on catch-up.
Ended up watching it because I was alerted to the quality of the match by student Matt, who tweeted that it was a glory to behold.
Oh, rub it in.
Yeah. And it was great. And David Goffin, first title since 2014. He'd lost 5 finals on the bounce.
Yeah. There we go. Well done, David. And after all that injury issues,
after all of that hoo-ha in France, that's all pretty good for him, isn't it?
Yeah.
Any other business, David?
Can I just say as well, Cam Norrie has won another challenger title and got himself inside the world's top 150. I did see one tweet from somebody who said, is he going to be the next one who's too good for the challengers but not good enough for the main tour? Which is a bit harsh because he hasn't really had a go at the main tour yet.
I really have no idea. He has a slightly funky technique. If you just look at his technique, he doesn't necessarily look like somebody that's destined to be top 30 or top 50 or necessarily. But, you know, there's so much unquantifiable about what makes a difference between a 120 in the world and a 60 in the world. And there is an awkward nether zone, which players can sort of be caught in, isn't there? Where you're... I don't think you did. I was going to say between about 80 in the world and 120 in the world.
Oh, I thought you were going to say between has been and never was.
How long have you had that line prepared?
Just came up with it.
Yeah, there is an awkward nether zone of, you know, you can be thrashing away on the Challenger Tour, but that can, it, no matter how well you do, it can only get your ranking so high. And you have to make the call to try and qualify for Masters and Grand Slam events. That effectively takes this huge chunk out of your season. You have to decide whether to invest in trying to make the leap up or stick around on the Challenger Tour, knowing that there's a ceiling to how high you can go.
Yeah, because there have been players that have got to 70 in the world in the past without even playing on a tour properly.
Absolutely. So there is going to be kind of a tipping point for Cam Norrie, I think. I like his attitude. He's got an interesting story, having gone through the college system. He's got a funky accent and a funky technique.
Cam.
No, I mean funky in terms of it's sort of three different accents rolled into one and you can't quite place it. I think South African born, moved to New Zealand, then to Texas for uni, but has Welsh and Scottish parents. So make of that what you will. But he's an interesting one to watch. So the next few weeks and months are going to be interesting. You'd hope that he can get just high enough for direct entry into the Aussie Open. That's surely got to be his immediate goal.
I would have thought he might just fall short on that because of the amount of tournaments left. But, you know, he's moving in that direction, isn't
he? And he qualified for the US Open, so... you know, he's not going to be afraid of the task of qualifying. While we're on Britwatch, should we do Jo Konta?
Yeah, I think we better.
What's going on?
Well, she's lost five matches in a row, and her last two matches she went love six, love one down, as I mentioned with Ash Barty, and then yesterday against Monica Niculescu, she went five love down after about 15 minutes, and she just could not play tennis. Like a tennis player does, you know, like a pro. So, I mean, not even it was what she was doing in the first set was not even top 50, not top 100. You know, she could not string rally balls together, and I don't know whether I think it's just lack of form, lack of wins, lack of confidence. Confidence is just everything, isn't it? Really, in any walk of life,
you kind of feel even more so to someone like Jo Konta. We know she is fragile. We know it. She's found this formula that works for her, but it does sometimes feel like a pack of cards, a house of cards that can just tumble down. And at the moment, it feels like it's in free fall. There is a caveat to all that, which for her and her style of play, she has had nightmare draws. As soon as I saw Monica Niculescu's name next to hers, I thought, oh, no.
Yeah, if you've not seen her play before, she hits slice forehands, not when she's stretched out wide like a squash shot, just when she's rallying the ball down the centre. A bit like...
Is she the David Law of the WTA? You described your game to me the other day as slice and dice,
yeah,
which is my nightmare.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
No, my nightmare in terms of... I just don't enjoy playing slice and
dice.
Great. David's face is lighting
up. I did
up.
Actually play my wife the other day, and although she beat me, I did discover too late in the day, but I did discover that if I stopped trying to hit these flowing topspin ground strokes and I just hit slices to her, she didn't like it. So I'm going to keep doing that.
Yeah, but there's no glory in that, David.
Oh, you think Monica Niculescu's worrying? Anyway, her game was too much for Jo Konta. 6-1, 6-2. I mean, Sam Smith said to me today that Konta needs to go play in Hong Kong next week, hopefully draw players that are a lot lower down and don't have such formidable games, and just give Konta some rhythm and some routine. I mean, she is still in pole position as things stand for WTA finals qualification. She's got an 800 point cushion, but there are players like Garcia and Van der Weij who could overhaul her, but basically they've got to win the title in Beijing.
How much do you think this is about the pressure of knowing that she can only lose Singapore now? She's in that pole position, she's been in it since she started this losing run, which, let's say, that started US Open first round against Alexandra Krunic. I don't think that was about Singapore, but let's say after that, it's been hers to lose, 100% hers to lose. We talked last week about how desperately she wants to get there. Do you think if she can just get over that line, get that qualification for Singapore, and... Okay, it's not 100% in her hands, but assuming she gets there, do you think suddenly then there'll be this big relief? She'll start playing that free-flowing confident brand of tennis of Joe Konta again, or do you think it's going to take some time to build up?
Well, I think there's a decent chance, particularly if she could get a semi-decent week somewhere beforehand. I think she's perfectly capable, with the pressure off, playing against better players in a situation like that, of turning it around and having a very decent WTA finals. But I don't know her well enough to know what makes her tick. I don't think any of us do, really. And also, she doesn't even know what's going on at the moment. I mean, it must be quite hard to take in that regard.
Have you been able to glean anything from Winfrey's visits to the court?
He came on at three love yesterday, and he said, "Look, now we start again. We build from here. Love three down, point by point." He's trying to do what he's done all year long to great success, which is to just keep her calm and focused and not panic. But at the moment, you can see her trying to be methodical, but her game is just gone, and I don't know where.
Are there parallels with Jeannie Bouchard on a more small timescale?
Maybe.
I remember once when we were first talking about the fall from grace of Jeannie Bouchard in terms of rankings. I can't remember if it was you or me or a third party, but she was described as like a malfunctioning robot. You know, the plan A, when it works, is great. You know, she stands her ground on that baseline. But then when it stops working, when the confidence goes, when someone slices and dices to her, it falls apart very, very quickly.
Neither one likes to take a backward step, and I'm not even sure that either one of them really could, game-wise. They are about standing up and trying to dominate from the baseline with metronomic and methodical, powerful ground strokes. That is their game, and I'm not sure that is adjustable particularly.
No, and it makes rhythm particularly important.
But I also think that Bouchard is so confident in her own ability that she refuses to believe that she can't just still go out and dominate people.
Surely the world number, you know, the number 80 something next to your name has got to make you lose confidence in your own ability.
Doesn't seem to be much of a shrinking violet to me. Doesn't seem to be overly concerned for her lack of form.
Is there an element of understatement there, David?
Yes.
Jeannie Bouchard, not a shrinking violet, says David Law. There's a headline.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Shall we move on to our movie review segment of the podcast?
Yes, why don't we do that? A tennis podcast first.
Beijing predictions? No, we don't have to. I don't know why I even mentioned Britney. Just no.
We've proved ourselves to be utterly unequipped.
Incompetent. Completely incompetent. So, we both seen Borg versus McEnroe this week, which, depending on what part of the world you're in, might be called Borg/McEnroe, or it might just be called Borg. Because I believe that's the title under which it was released in Sweden. It's a Swedish-made film, or largely produced by a Swedish production company. So the emphasis is on the telling of the Borg-McEnroe rivalry from the Borg perspective. Although they do attempt a little bit to delve into the psyche of McEnroe, but he's definitely the foil to Borg's leading man. It focuses on a snapshot in time of their rivalry about June, July 1980, the time of their famous Wimbledon final, where they played the 16-14 tiebreak, won by McEnroe, but the eventual final won by Borg. That's the denouement of the film. David Law, movie reviewer, how many stars are you giving it?
I would give it 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5. Now, the movie posters around London have been all featuring the reviewer's quote, not from David Law, from somebody who actually does movie reviewing for a living, saying,
"Not that I could.
This is the best tennis movie of all time." Now, I think that's the faintest of faint praise with which a film could be damned. Yeah, I don't know about you.
I don't think I've seen them all.
I could only think of two.
Yeah, I've not seen them all.
One is the dreadful Match Point Woody Allen film, and the other is Wimbledon, which doesn't deserve any of our breath or airtime. It is unequivocally the best tennis film I've ever seen.
Do you know, I actually saw the film Wimbledon at a preview screening in New York ahead of the 2003 US Open, alongside just about every tennis player and every coach and every agent and every official that I knew in tennis.
Were there groans?
And there was uproarious laughter at the staging of the Wimbledon final on court 2 at Wimbledon, the set piece matches of where you're meant to believe that some of these rallies are real. I mean, they're so badly handled.
Yeah. And that is something. So Borg McEnroe uses zero
1816, by the way, the tie break.
1816. It uses zero archive footage. Which, depending on your view, I went to see it with a colleague of mine from Eurosport. She wished there had been archive footage. I thought it was all so well done, that aspect of it, the match play aspect of it, that I was sort of I was reveling in that, in how well it was done. So it didn't bother me so much. I know what has bothered John McEnroe. He's given some fantastic quotes about it. He said, they've made me look like a jerk, and he says, I was a jerk, but at least accurately portray me as a jerk. He says, you know, some of the stories that made him look like a jerk weren't true. You know, why not tell the truthful stories that made him look like a jerk?
Well, I know for a fact that one or two of the things that they did portray about him, he didn't like very much, as you say. Actually, what I would say, though, is he watched that film, I am reliably told, on a computer before it was released publicly. So he didn't see the final cut of it. Now, I believe one of the scenes that he was upset about has been altered already, so he probably won't be quite as upset about it now.
Out of interest, and I'll try and do this without spoilers, is it the scene involving Peter Fleming?
It was indeed. So if you see that scene, you'll know what we're referring to. The other thing, and I was watching this film with my wife, and I remarked to her, because she was trying to get my opinion about what I thought about what was happening throughout and whether it was accurate and stuff. One thing that, and I usually don't like to talk at all when films are going on.
And you were talking during the film?
Well, she was just whispering, asking me little questions.
Cripes,
you know?
David.
So anyway, but what I did say is that I have never, and maybe I've just missed it, but I've never seen John McEnroe spit on a tennis court. And he was depicted as spitting on a tennis court. And I just thinking, I've never seen him do that, to be honest.
The one thing,
and he wasn't happy about that.
Now, at the start it says inspired by true events, and I always think, well, if you can't even say based on true events, this is essentially not based on reality at all. But the one thing that I specifically wanted to know whether it was real or not was at a change of ends during that final, I think midway through the fourth set, so in the build-up to that tiebreak, they depicted Borg saying to McEnroe, just chill out, we're having a great match at the check. Did that happen?
I'm not sure.
I cannot
to be
believe
honest.
That happened. Look,
first of all, I'm not sure whether it happened it precisely, but one of the reasons I would give it 4 out of 5. Now, first of all, I completely agree with you that the depiction of the action scenes of the actual points in that final was wonderfully done, because it felt real. It looked like them in terms of the style of their shots. They'd got the Borg backhand down to a tee. They'd got the McEnroe side on serve. They'd they were actually depicting the points as they happened. And the reason that really you would not have the same impact if you did it from live footage is you've only got two cameras on things in that instance. This was much more dramatically done. You felt like you were in the final, which was great. That specific moment where Borg almost kind of tried to just calm him down, I'm not sure whether it happened, but what I do know, having known them for many years since then, or at least post-career, is that that is the kind of relationship that they have. They have a deep understanding as two people who are always depicted as such opposites, and yet have got a heck of a lot in common, and truly love each other. I mean, they
really
have
do.
Enormous respect, affection for one another. They love to be in each other's company. They shared something that they feel nobody else did. It is absolutely fact that John McEnroe didn't lose his temper in matches against Bjorn Borg because he had such respect for him, such time for him. And Borg had a soothing effect on him. And equally, Borg could see the good in John McEnroe, right back to that, to those moments. And I think that is one of the things that the film did a wonderful job of, is just quietly, almost unspokenly showing their understanding of one another, even before they really knew each other. And I loved that. As somebody who's kind of dealt with them post-career and seen how affectionate they are towards one another, I really enjoyed that. At some point I'll write a blog about other examples of experience I've got of the two of them together and what they're like. But no, I thought it was really well handled. I really enjoyed the fact that they had subtitles for much of the Swedish conversation that was going on. I think that one of the things my wife said to me is, you can tell that this is not produced in Hollywood. The fact that it allows certain scenes to breathe and just looks to tell you the story and doesn't require somebody almost shouting out, "This is what's happening next, everybody."
Yeah, I agree. I would agree 4 stars out of 5. I enjoyed it a lot more than I expected to. The performances were magnificent. Now, this next sentence is going to feature very high on the list of words I never thought I'd say, but Shia LaBeouf, what a performance. I thought he was amazing.
Yeah, he was very good.
It's John McEnroe.
I know that the McEnroe camp are not completely convinced about his depiction, but
Who would John McEnroe enjoy depicting it? I mean, well, I cannot imagine him going, "Yeah, that was great.
And look,
you do me as well as I do me." He's not saying those words.
The one thing I do think that they didn't depict. Now, again, I didn't know John McEnroe back then, so we've since got to know him and we're aware of his humour. And there was no humour really in that performance, I didn't think. Now, that
there
might
was no humour in the script, though.
No, but there wasn't the twinkle in the eye that we know John McEnroe has. Now, that may just be post-career. Maybe he didn't exhibit that back in the day. But what he did have, I could relate to that person's performance. And, you know, in terms of the behaviour being appalling and yet still getting this feeling that he's not all bad.
Yeah. I just think it's an incredible... This, of course, applies to Borg as well. I think it's an incredibly tough task depicting a real-life human being and not making it a caricature.
It is.
And I thought that was achieved.
And it is one of the reasons why... The one problem I have with the film is the fact that it didn't stick to the facts, the true events. Now, I'm not sure if you properly collaborated with John McEnroe whether he would almost allow you to tell the story your way, because he'd be so keen to do it his way, much as I like the bloke, that I'm not sure it would work. But I do think it's a shame that we even have this question mark over the facts, because even if they were literally making stuff up, they got the feel right.
Yeah, well, your issue with it is the same as John McEnroe's issue with it. The facts are good enough. You don't need to fabricate or exaggerate or, you know... He said, if only they'd asked me, I've got cracking stories I could have told them. But anyway, I think it's a good watch. If you like tennis, go for it. A friend of mine watched it and she said she didn't know who won the tiebreak or the match. So she found the end tremendously exciting.
Don't tell anybody.
So yeah, I'd say go for it.
Me too. I really enjoyed it.
We'll have to do
Battle of the Sexes in a few months.
Officially the best tennis film of all time. We will. It's out in America, and I know that because they were doing the press junket for it at the US Open over finals weekend, and I witnessed the stars having these very Hollywood lovey type interviews where they're all, you know, sat at sofas in the Players' Garden. And even if I didn't recognise them, I could tell the ones that were actors a mile off because they just exuded this sort of...
Oh, and how similar did that bloke look to Bjorn Borg in terms of his mannerisms? I mean, he had something special about him. He was mesmerising, the actor who played
Bjorn Borg. He was sensational. And a lovely touch, the actor that played the youngest version of young Borg. There were several young Borgs of varying degrees of likeness, but the youngest one was Leo, Bjorn's youngest son,
who was excellent,
who was marvellous, and is a decent junior player. I think he's 15 years old. He's playing some junior events.
And Jaakko Nieminen was the choreographer for all the tennis scenes.
These are great facts
about that. That was given to me by one of our listeners whose name I'm so sorry I've forgotten.
But I mean, Jaakko Nieminen hasn't had his name mentioned on the tennis podcast for a while, so that's nice for him, isn't it? He's been sitting and waiting. So that is our movie review segment over with. There'll be another at the end of November when Battle of the Sexes comes out.
Unfortunately,
I've read some reviews of it because it's already out in the States.
Don't tell me.
All right.
Don't want to know.
Okay, right, well, that you've rather cut me short. What else have we got? We've got some... we have done our first wedding message this week, David. More words than I never thought I'd say. I think that's probably just below Shia LaBeouf putting a good performance on the list of things I never thought I'd say. Yeah, we did a wedding message.
We did, to Chris and Livy, who got married, and we're so happy for them.
And they posted a picture on Twitter. Do you know what? When we got the request for it, I thought this could be a wind-up. Who wants a wedding message from David, Laura and Catherine Whittaker?
Yeah, but who wants to wind somebody up by asking for a wedding message?
I don't know. People go to great lengths.
Don't do it, all right, you lot?
Apparently, Pat Sharp receives 250 hoax requests for his DJing services per week. Pat Sharp of Funhouse fame?
Nope, you lost me. Clearly not as famous as us.
Funhouse, a whole lot of fun. He's now a DJ and available to DJ your events. But anyway, I think people do go to quite long lengths to wind people up. But I'm delighted to say lovely Chris and Livy weren't two of those people. We genuinely seem to have enhanced their joy by a modicum. And that's lovely. They posted a lovely picture. And that's just great.
All we did was say, hello, this is Catherine and David, and you're listening to Chris and Livy's wedding playlist. That's all we did.
Yeah, we are available for other messages, free of charge, unless we get inundated. Brian Blessed for the...
Hold on a minute, we haven't talked this through.
Brian Blessed for the cool price of $1,000 will record your answer machine message.
Really?
Yeah,
right,
for anyone.
Give me ideas
a
now.
Grand. So there you go, if you've got a grand to spare and you want a cool answer machine message, go to Brian Blessed. But if you want one for free, come to us.
Well, she's saying that, I'm not saying that.
Any other business, David, before I start telling you about other random celebrities that will do things for a paltry amount of money?
One bit of news that we were very sad to read about was that our favourite tennis podcast guest ever, Mary Carrillo, wasn't very well recently. She was clearing up after Hurricane Irma had done its worst in her home in Florida, and she had a nasty fall, punctured a lung. So we were really sad to hear that. We've sent our very best wishes from both of us to Mary, from all of you, from Rosie the dog, from Magic the cat, from Catherine's brother, Catherine's dad, everybody we know associated with the tennis podcast, because she's a listener, as you know, and she's thanked us all for that, and she is already on the mend, happy to say, but get well soon, Mary.
She needs to be well mended in time for the tennis luge double coming up in January, February. She's going to be my Australian Open Olympics buddy. She doesn't know that yet.
She's got another couple of impersonations for us as well to go alongside her Arantxa Sánchez. She also says she's got a cracker of Monica Seles, if we'd like to hear it, and Nick Bollettieri. But Monica Seles, she says, would beat players in 12 minutes flat, come into the press room explaining in great galloping detail how much tougher the match was than the score suggested.
I think there's a few players that could have that accusation levelled at them.
Indeed.
Rafa does that, doesn't he? It was a tough match. It was love and love, Rafa.
I suppose you could come in and just say, I mean, really, honestly, she was just terrible. And I was brilliant.
The Yelena Ostapenko approach.
Yeah, that's the end of the match.
This was my worst match ever. Bye.
Mic drop.
I think that is it. Yeah. So we've been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you, and the Tennis Podcast Movie Review Show.
Yeah.
Brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport. And we'll be back next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.